Mr. President, welcome to A Closer Look. Thank you very much for making the time.
Thank you, Dennis. It's good to be with you and all your listeners.
Now, these elections are the result of a standoff, really, between the incumbent president, Donald Ramotar, and the opposition in parliament. He suspended parliament and called for these early elections. So have your observers seen indications that the process has been fairly set up?
I think everyone with whom we've spoken has confidence in the election commission and the way they prepared for the election. Of course, nobody knows what's going to happen on election day. And no one knows how the winners and losers will accept the election results, whether they'll be accepted graciously by both sides or not. In the past, as you know, Guyana has been very deeply polarized, primarily between Afro-Guyanese, whose ancestors came over from Africa as slaves, and Indo-Guyanese, whose ancestors came over to Guyana as indentured servants. And so they have been not only ethnically divided, but also politically divided. I was here for the first time in 1992. Prior to that time, for almost 30 years, the Afro-Guyanese had prevailed. And in that election, which we monitored, the Indo-Guyanese took over the responsibility for government, and they've been in power ever since. There may be a change between parties. Nobody knows until the returns come in.
Yeah, and you've actually had a handful of observers in the country since April, with a bigger team, including yourself, arriving this past week or so. But is that first group, who's been there for a while, big enough, though, to make sure that abuses don't occur before Election Day? Because you can certainly have smooth elections that are rigged beforehand.
Well, the early observers who come in here that we call long-term observers, they are here to learn about the country and to observe what goes on. They get to know the political parties. They get to know the geography, the history of the country. They get to know the issues that are divisive between the two parties and the prospects for the election. And, of course, when the short-term observers get here, including me and about 50 other people, the long-term observers give us a complete report, kind of a crash program on the country itself. And if they have observed anything that is of concern before we arrive, they report that to us. So I would say the short-term observers, including me, are quite well aware of the country's situation, either because we've been there before for other elections or other visits, or because the long-term observers have given us an up-to-date report.
But over the years, has that advance team, do you think, been able to really get to possibly the most secret abuses? Because someone might say, okay, you don't really have a chance of finding those unless you've really lived in a place.
Well, I think that problem is overcome by the extent of the conversations that we have with leaders of the parties, with staff members, with incumbents who serve in the parliament and in the executive branch, and also the judiciary, as a matter of fact. We meet with religious leaders. We meet with civil leaders. We meet with youth. We meet with all elements of the society to get their very frank and honest, and I would say unrestrained, assessment. Sometimes some of the allegations, when we investigate, we find that they are exaggerated or untrue. But they try to give us the best approach that we can get from a whole area of a constituency who lives here.
And you mentioned just a moment ago, this is hardly the first time you've been in Guyana. Your team was there in 92, also in 2001, 2006. And there are other countries where you've made multiple visits. Venezuela, for instance, which is right next to Guyana, is another one. Is that an indication that it's one thing to monitor elections and quite another to assure that any improvements will actually stick?
Well, one of our big duties when we come into Guyana or other countries is to make a thorough analysis of the way the election has just been conducted. And we make quite a voluminous report, sometimes 25 or 30 pages, assessing the way the election was conducted by the people. And we make detailed recommendations on how they could improve before the next election is held. And, of course, it's up to the people who live here to make those decisions. Sometimes we recommend changes in the Constitution. Sometimes it changes in the basic laws. Sometimes changes in the rules and regulations that are issued by the Election Commission. And we don't ever have any authority. We don't want that any authority, but we have complete freedom to meet with whom we choose, to assess the situation as we believe it ought to be, and to make our decisions and recommendations in a completely unrestrained and open and fair way.
Now, you started with elections in Panama back in 1989, and as you look back over these 100 missions over, I think it's 38 countries, where do you think you've made the biggest difference, and is there a place where you've experienced, you know, your greatest frustrations?
Well, I think Panama is one example. We condemned that election as completely fraudulent, which it was, and then those candidates who were trying to seek office on the fraudulent side did not even try to take over as incumbent officials. I think the biggest election that we've held, probably with the most long-lasting effect, has been in Indonesia. Indonesia had had a dictatorship for about 50 years, and we went in as a first observer. At that time, they had 48 parties, and the president was elected indirectly. We elected the parliament first, and then the parliamentary members chose the president. When we went back 5 years later, they had direct elections for president, and I think that Indonesia is now one of the sterling examples of democracy in the world. It happens to be the largest Muslim country on earth. We've also done elections all over Africa, and I would say that the biggest change that that my life has made in our commitment to human rights has been in Latin America, particularly South America. When I became president, for instance, there were military dictatorships in Colombia and in Peru and Ecuador and in Chile and Argentina and Uruguay and Paraguay and Brazil. Almost the entire continent of South America was a military dictatorship. We initiated our human rights program when I was president, and soon all of those countries, and even now, they're completely democratic regimes in different ways, but they all have changed into democracy. So I don't think there's any doubt that international observation and a commitment to human rights has opened up the door of freedom and democracy to many people.
Has there ever been a case where you thought, and I'm thinking perhaps of the Congo, where you found incidents of violence and some voter fraud, and yet you said, okay, the elections were overall fairly well done? Has there been cases like that where you thought, well, there were abuses and some people were denied access, but, you know, this is an imperfect world and this is better than nothing?
Well, we've done two elections in the Democratic Republic of Congo. The first election, I think, was an accurate representation of the will of the people. The second one that we monitored was not. And we have been in countries that where we condemned the election process, and we've had to leave in a hurry. For instance, we were in Peru. We condemned the re-election of Fujimori, and we left the country under pressure, and then Fujimori ran for election despite the fact that we had condemned the process. He didn't have any opposition at all. He ran by himself. He only got 51% of the votes. And now, then subsequently, he was removed from office. We were also in Togo once, and we condemned the election about 3 days before election day because it was completely fraudulent. And my wife and I had to escape in the middle of the night and go into nearby Benin. So we've had some difficulties, but I would say most of the time, the Carter Center has been received graciously, and our services in the countries involved have been appreciated, and we've been honored subsequently.
Just shifting gears for a moment, for just a moment, over a week ago, you were in the Middle East for a three-day visit, but according to the reports that we read, you did not even request a meeting with Prime Minister Netanyahu. And first of all, is that true? And secondly, why not try, even though you might be turned down?
Well, we had asked to meet with Netanyahu's cabinet and himself two or three times in the past when the so-called group of elders went there, and we had been rejected by Netanyahu, so we didn't even try to meet with him or his cabinet on this occasion. So we didn't ask for meeting with him or his cabinet, but we did meet with representatives from the government. We met with the leaders of the opposition party. We met with the freedom groups. We met with many others. We met with the Palestinian leaders and so forth. And so we achieved the goals that we established for our meeting there. And also the elders group and the Carter Center as well. We stand for freedom and peace and for human rights. And I really didn't think that that was compatible in its basic goals with what Netanyahu and his new government stand for. I don't think they are committed to peace with the Palestinians. And obviously, there's a very serious problem with their government.
But the Palestinians, some might say, are divided among themselves between Fatah and Hamas. And why should Israel's government move toward a two-state solution when a Palestinian election might go to Hamas, which stands for the destruction of Israel? How would you respond to a question like that, which I'm sure you've heard before?
Well, I think the best way for Israel to ever have peace with its immediate neighbor, that is the Palestinians, is for the Palestinians to be united. The Carter Center monitored the election in 2006 when the United States and Israel encouraged Hamas candidates to contend for the election seats in the parliament. And Hamas won a majority of the seats. Subsequent to that, Hamas was declared to be a terrorist organization, and all of the candidates who won the parliamentary seats in East Jerusalem or in the West Bank were imprisoned by the Israelis. They were farmers, and they were lawyers, and they were college professors and so forth, who were not committed at all to violence, but just was supporting their own particular party's choice. So I hope that in the future we'll see the Palestinians united, recognize Israel's right to exist and exist in peace, and able to establish their own nation and own government alongside Israel with mutual respect. That's what I hope for. By the way, that's the official policy of the United Nations. It's been the official policy of every president in the United States and our Congress. It's been the policy of the so-called quartet, which comprises the United Nations and the European Union and Russia and the United States. It's a policy of the world to have a two-state solution.
One other quick thought on another subject. You and Mrs. Carter have been scheduled to do a Habitat for Humanity project in Nepal in November, and obviously that was scheduled before the earthquake took place.
Yes, we'll still be going now.
You'll still be going?
Oh, yes, of course. And I'll be meeting with the Habitat leaders this week, as a matter of fact, to determine whether or not to change our location of house building from Pokhara, where we plan to go, to a different place that's been more severely affected by the earthquake. So we'll be building roughly 100 new houses or repairing old houses in Nepal later on this year.
And obviously, when you look at a mission like that, where you're building some places, and yet now the task seems so enormous, what do you hope will come out of that when you look at the massive job that they have ahead of them?
Well, my wife and I and several thousand volunteers, we went to Haiti 2 years in a row to build homes for people who were affected in the much worse earthquake in Haiti. And when they had an earthquake in Chengdu, China, the next year we were there building homes for Chinese people in that area. So this won't be new to us. When the tsunami struck in India and in Indonesia and so forth, we were there building homes in India and up and down the coast after the tsunami struck. So this has been a normal thing for Habitat, to go into areas that were most in need. And we look forward to going back to Nepal.
Mr. President, congratulations on the 100th election monitoring milestone, and thank you so much for giving us this time. We really appreciate it. We'll see you back in Atlanta.
I look forward to that. We'll be back soon. Thank you very much.